This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Maloe la malie aho eki pea moi kainga Pasifiki Honokotoa. My name is Alice Lolo here. This is Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Today on the show, it's been 1 year since deadly riots rocked New Caledonia, and a year on, the territory still has no clear path to self-determination. Coming up, I'll speak with FLNKS member Jimmy Nauna about what comes next. And in Papua New Guinea, a video of gendered violence has gone viral, sparking outrage online.
So a lot of people who were commenting were just disgusted by the violence, and they were calling for people to be arrested.
You'll hear the latest updates on that situation coming up soon. These stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. In Papua New Guinea, a video allegedly showing a woman and child being beaten in a supermarket has gone viral, sparking outrage online. There's been a swell of community support for the police to address the issue and to identify the perpetrators. PNG journalist Scott Wade has been helping coordinate community response and spoke to reporter Jordan Fennell, saying more effort must be made to end domestic and gendered violence in the country.
In the video, when I first saw it, I didn't know what was happening, but somebody forwarded it to me, and then several others did the same thing. It's a video of mother and a child, a very young child, I think between 7 and 10, being abused by several adults. Yeah, she was kicked, punched, hit with a stick, and then practically body slammed, picked up and thrown across the room to against a stock of rice. So yeah, that's what was happening in the video.
And like you say, the video was obviously being shared around, forwarded to yourself and things like that. What was the response to this video from the public, from the police and online?
Yeah, there wasn't any much of a response from police initially. The NCDC police Facebook page, which is run by another communications professional, and the policeman took the video and then asked for details to the mother and child, or asked for the location of the shop. And then they, after viewing it, you know, this is not the first time that children have been abused in that manner after being accused. So I went on, just recorded a short video. It was, you know, done in haste. I was very angry when I posted it. And it just went viral. People started sharing and giving information. So we started collecting information about the shop, because I didn't know where the shop was, and many people didn't know where the shop was, so they started giving the information, and eventually they started getting various other calls from authorities asking about the shop owner, the location, and the identity of the children, child and the mother.
Yeah, and tell me a little bit about why did you feel the need to make that video and be asking the public for that information? What sort of gap were you trying to fill there?
The thing was that a lot of people were angry, but I guess they were looking for somebody to put the pieces together and call for that, the authorities to act on it, because we've had incidences like that before, but it hasn't come to the stage where many of those cases didn't come to the stage where those people were actually arrested and charged. I mean, they would offer compensation to the victims and then keep it quiet. But a lot of people were calling for the arrest of those perpetrators and for them to be jailed. That was the thrust of the narrative that was happening on social media. The other thing is that we've had instances previously where, you know, kids have been... I know personally of an incident where a young boy and a girl, brother and sister, were locked in a freezer as punishment by security guards, and they froze to death. This was many years ago. And there was another incident again last year where I spoke about it also, where a girl was caught and then beaten and shamed on Facebook. Her pictures were taken without her consent, and she was shared on Facebook with a lot of people getting very angry about it.
So, yeah, with this move of you going online, posting your video, asking for information, the community coming together to help provide that information, since then, what developments have we seen take place, especially with the police involvement?
So I've had the police, provincial police commander of Medang, release a statement saying that calling for witness statements, any witness statements at all. He's been able to bring in the mother and the child, bring the mother and the child to the Medang police station where they've had their statements taken.
In PNG, gendered violence, domestic violence is a huge issue. In this particular video, there was a mother and a young child being allegedly targeted. What does this incident tell you or reveal about the attitudes towards gendered violence in PNG at the moment?
Yeah, unfortunately, people think it's normal. Many people think it's normal, and a lot of people who in this case, you know, I think a lot of awareness has gone out. So a lot of people who were commenting were just disgusted by the violence, and they were calling for people to be arrested. But there are still, you know, large sections of society that feel that disciplining, you know, quote, again in quotation marks, disciplining women and children in that manner is acceptable. So we're trying to create a generation that is violence free. And I think this, you know, small steps like this, community action like this will help.
That was PNG journalist Scott Wade speaking there. And there has been a further development with police identifying and arresting three alleged suspects in the case. It was on this day exactly 1 year ago that New Caledonia's capital, Noumea, was rocked by months of deadly protests and riots, the worst in 40 years. At the centre of the violence was an attempt by President Emmanuel Macron to introduce electoral reforms, giving voting rights to French residents living in the territory. The violence led to 13 deaths as the country went into a state of emergency. Now a year on, the country is still in talks with no clear path to self-determination and voting rights. This morning we have Jimmy Nauna, member of the Kanaki New Caledonia Pro-Independence FLNKS Political Bureau, on the line from Noumea. Welcome to the show, Jimmy.
Yes, good morning. Thank you.
Firstly, how is your homeland holding up since these riots? How has life been for you, for your family, for work?
I can say life has got back to some normalcy. Business has started up again, and you know, it's been quiet now. It's been stable since the last few months, but there's still some, you know, pockets of tensions. And you know, today is anniversary a year ago, so you know, there's some suspicions or expectations that things might erupt again, but it's pretty calm today, so I don't think anything you know, major would happen. There's some events happening around the country just to mark you know, the 1 year anniversary of that eruption, but I don't think anything violent will erupt today, hopefully.
And thinking back to a year ago, where were you when the riots broke out?
I was in the middle of town in Noumea, and things, you know, started, you know, getting worse around the city, mainly around the capital city of Noumea. So, you know, these events mainly concentrated around the major cities. It didn't spread to the whole country, so things were sort of, you know, focused around the capital city. So yeah, everything happened around Noumea mainly. Yeah.
When you look at you know, the 1 year commemoration of the riots, and you look at all sides, do you think all sides have put the violence behind them and moved towards peace?
Yeah, there's been talks. You know, you must be aware there's been talks with you know, France, and the Minister for Overseas Territories was here a couple of days ago trying to reach an agreement with different political parties. Unfortunately, fed through, but discussions are still ongoing, and we're hoping to resume the talks you know, so that, you know, we can get over this this situation and, you know, reach a new political agreement for the way forward.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, French Minister for Overseas Manuel Valls has been in the country for talks about New Caledonia's political future and status. If LNKS was there, so what came of those meetings?
I'm sorry, we can come again.
The French Minister Manuel Valls was in the country, and if LNKS was there, what came of those meetings?
What came of those meetings? Well, there was some kind of, you know, agreement to you know, a new referendum of self-determination in a couple of years' time. But unfortunately, you know, some parties, mainly the non-independence parties, did not agree to it. So they had to stop the talks and, you know, they would set up a committee, you know, to continue the discussions and the negotiations and, you know, have another round of our negotiations in the coming months. But ultimately, the objective of all political parties is to reach a new political agreement, you know, a post-Nouméa Accord political agreement that sets a new schedule towards a new referendum on independence. This is what we pro-independence parties are asking for, you know, to go for another referendum because we didn't take part in the third one in 2021. And that's for us a way forward out of this, you know, most violent situation, so that we can, you know, we can, you know, all agree to a new political process towards a referendum. That's what we're trying to reach and get out of these negotiations with France and the non-independent parties.
So do you think that there's some movement towards a replacement for the Nouméa Accord?
Yeah, definitely. We're hoping. I mean, there's no other way around it. You know, we can't go back. So, you know, we're building a new political agreement on the basis of the Nouméa Accords and all the transfers of powers over the last, you know, 30 years. So it's just a matter of reaching a new political agreement so that we can, you know, consider transferring the remaining sovereign powers and then, you know, put a new political agreement to a new referendum, you know, in 5 years' time or you know. And then, you know, ask New Caledonians to vote on that new project, you know, with independence in partnership with France or, you know, like non-pro-independence groups are aiming for to have a, you know, something like a federated state within France, Republic. You know, so those are different alternatives or options that, you know, that we put to a new referendum in 5 years' time or in the next referendum. But definitely there has to be a new political agreement, you know, and beyond the Nouméa Accord.
Yes, and besides the Nouméa Accord and the focus on the referendum, what else should the government be focusing on now for the people?
Definitely rebuilding the economy, which is going slow. There's been a lot of, you know, loss in jobs and employment. A lot of people are migrating also out of New Caledonia. So there needs to be, support to the economy so that, you know, we can rebuild the economy and, you know, people can get their job and employment back. And, you know, it's a matter of economic and social, development for the country to go forward and to also, you know, being built in parallel to the political discussions.
Now, the French government is facing its own issues and focused on Donald Trump and potential ramifications from his administration's decisions. Do you feel that New Caledonia remains a priority to the French government?
Yes, I think definitely. I mean, France has been putting forward its Indo-Pacific strategy, so I think New Caledonia plays an important role in that. You know, Indo-Pacific strategy for France and its allies. So, I think definitely New Caledonia plays an important role in, you know, how in France, you know, foreign policy. But at the same time, France also faces national issues, and you know, the current government is not quite a stable government. There might be some, you know, rescheduling of the current. Government in Paris, so they have also their own national issues. So, but definitely, you know, in terms of foreign policy, I think France, I mean, New Caledonia, they still play an important role in France foreign policy.
And just lastly, Jimmy, I understand there's an increase in French military in New Caledonia because of the anniversary. Do you expect a peaceful anniversary?
Yes, definitely. I think, well, there's been some, like I said, organizing events around the country to mark 1 year anniversary, but I don't expect much violence like it happened a year ago. And yes, there's been a build up of military, definitely police forces around the country, especially around the capital city of Nouméa. But I don't think, you know, people want to go back to what we've gone through, you know, 12 months ago. So I think people are looking ahead now to rebuild the country and, you know, work together towards a new political agreement. So, yeah, there might be some pockets of tension today, but I don't expect any form of, you know, spread violence like we saw, you know, 12 years ago. Hopefully, I hope, for the country. Yeah.
We hope too, Jimmy. Thank you very much. Jimmy Nauna, member of the Kanakia New Caledonia Pro-Independence FLNKS Political Bureau. Pacific Beat. China has become embroiled in a foreign interference controversy in Solomon Islands after allegedly forcing a newly appointed minister to quit an international group pushing back against Beijing's global influence. Over the weekend, Solomon Islands' new rural development minister, Daniel Waneoroa, said he'd quit the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China in order to maintain the unity of the government. But some of Solomon Islands' MPs and civil society groups have accused Beijing of meddling in domestic politics and suggested Beijing threatened to withdraw funding for development programs in the Pacific nation. China's embassy in Honiara has forcefully denied it's engaged in foreign interference. Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts joins us now with the latest. Good morning, Dizzy. How are you?
Good morning.
Now, Stephen, what has sparked this controversy exactly?
Well, this controversy first broke really into public view on Saturday when the press in Solomon Islands published a statement from Transparency Solomon Islands, which is a pretty well-known civil society group in Solomon Islands. Now, in that statement, Transparency Solomon Islands essentially accused China of meddling in the domestic politics of Solomon Islands. In the statement, they said that, in particular, China had been trying to place pressure on the new Minister for Rural Development, Daniel Waneoroa, over his membership of a group which is called the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China. Now, this is basically an international gathering of parliamentarians from around the world who share skepticism about China, who are worried about China's growing global influence and who want to work together to push back against that. Now, obviously, this is a very sensitive topic for China. It's been very hostile towards this group. It reportedly last year pressured a number of developing nations not to send MPs to a global conference in Taiwan, a gathering of this group. And according to Transparency Solomon Islands, China's embassy in Honiara had both requested a meeting with the new rural development minister over his membership of this group and laid down, as they put it, quote, conditions to the minister over his membership of that group if he wanted to continue to work with them on rural development. So the implications seem to be that, according to Transparency Solomon Islands, that China had essentially threatened to pull funding for development programs if he didn't take action or withdraw from this group. Now, that obviously drew an angry response from the Chinese embassy. It denied any foreign interference. It didn't address any of the actual specific allegations. It didn't say that it had or hadn't sought a meeting with the new Minister for Rural Development. But it did say that any allegations of, quote, foreign interference were baseless. And then the final development came later on Sunday when the minister himself put out a statement through the Prime Minister's press department or the government press department acknowledging the value of his experience with IPAC, but saying that he'd decided to withdraw from the group in the interests of national unity and ensuring a consistent stance. So that's where it stands at the moment. Unsurprisingly, AIPAC has responded furiously, accusing China of neo-colonialism and bullying behavior, saying it's a shocking infringement of Solomon Islands' sovereignty. There hasn't been a huge amount of political reaction yet in Solomon Islands, but obviously this is being tracked internationally as well, with quite a few people who watch China's influence in the Pacific more broadly, tracking very closely how this story develops.
And has there been any comment from Australia on the story?
No comment from Australia yet, no. Australia, unsurprisingly, is also watching this pretty closely. As you well know, Australia is pretty anxious about China's influence in Solomon Islands, and there is a constant subterranean, sometimes arm wrestle between China and Australia for influence in Solomon Islands. We've seen that most recently with Australia's push to try and get essentially a new policing memorandum of understanding signed with Honiara, which is linked to its push to hand about $200 million to Solomon Islands to help really massively expand its police force. That is seen as an attempt to not just help Solomon Islands, but also to box out China, to try and embed Australia as the main security partner for Solomon Islands. But China, unsurprisingly, sees it in a very hostile way and has been working behind the scenes to register its concerns with Solomon Islands. Now, I think in some ways this is also part of the story here, in the sense that China is perhaps feeling like it's a little bit on the back foot at the moment in Solomon Islands with Jeremiah Manele. Not that Mr. Manele is in any way hostile to China. After all, it's very plausible that he insisted the new Minister for Rural Development make this decision in order to avoid infuriating China. But obviously Australia has made a bit of progress recently on this front, and China is obviously now redoubling its efforts, not just to reinforce its ties as a development partner, but also to reinforce its influence more broadly as well.
Thanks very much for that update. That is Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jidget speaking to us there.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, since 2016, Kate Walker has led voluntary efforts to restore the Niikau Cemetery in the Cook Islands, the final resting place for generations of Cook Islands families, visitors and veterans of World War I and II. Now, the Cook Islands Investment Corporation is stepping in to support restoration and management of the cemetery, a major investment in the long-term future of the site. Lucy Cooper caught up with Kate, who was on site at the Cook Islands, to find out how it all began.
In late 1977, my mother, Gloria Walker, travelled to the Cook Islands where a self-proclaimed cancer therapist by the name of Milan Brick had set up a practice following his, I guess you could say, expulsion from New Zealand when they discovered he had falsified his medical qualifications when entering New Zealand as a refugee from Czechoslovakia in the late 60s. So my mother came over about November, December 1977, and she passed away here on Easter Sunday, actually, March 23rd, 1978. I visited the cemetery, the Niikau Cemetery, where my mother was buried in 2007. Cemetery was not looking good. It was washing away. A lot of graves had been lost to the sea. There was headstones down on the shoreline. And then with raising a family, and I didn't really have time to revisit things until 2014, my husband and I revisited, and by then the cemetery was really in a bad state. It was just a mess, and I thought I'll do something about this now. So I contacted the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and then about a year later I got the confirmation that the cemetery is on Crown land. Then later, a number of groups were voluntarily maintaining the site. A lot of the cancer patients' families were coming over to visit, met with heaps of them here, as well as our volunteers rebuilding graves. But in 2014, it wasn't until 2016 when I appeared on Television New Zealand, a segment about the cemetery, I was contacted by Mr. Bobby Nicholas in Auckland, and he said his great-grandfather was actually buried beside the cancer patient section, which at that time was a jungle. I didn't know what was in there. And that he said he thought that there was a large group of Cook Islands World War One soldiers buried in there. So we cleared that site. We came back over mid-2016. We cleared the soldiers section and came back the next year focused on the soldiers section as well. We've been just slowly but surely doing that. But then as we did that, I was just getting so many messages to our Nikau Cemetery page asking where their Cook Islands World War One soldier was buried. And that was really the formation of our project.
When you first decided to go and maintain and recover and restore the graves in the cemetery, could you describe in what state they were in?
Oh, it was terrible. They were neglected, overgrown. A number had washed off graves. A rock seawall was built. So at least with that there, it has prevented the loss of any more graves from that cemetery, but many have been lost to the sea. We have recovered a number of headstones prior to the rock seawall being built and have built memorials for soldiers, Cook Island soldiers in the cemetery. So, yeah, it's certainly a huge difference in the cemetery now, particularly now. Last week I got the great news after revisiting that with the government, Cook Islands Investment Corporation, that is in charge of maintaining Crown land. They're very proactive. They've already been in there for 2 days. The site looks amazing. So yeah, we've got a plan now for the future. We're just going to work together to beautify the site. There are a number of graves in there because public cemeteries are uncommon in the Cook Islands. Most people are buried on family land, could be at their house, could be a private family land's burial ground. So public cemeteries are very uncommon here. And most of the people buried there are not from Rarotonga. They had no family land to be buried on.
To know that there's a plan in place, how has that made you feel after, you know, really decades of work?
Well, speechless, actually. I was in complete shock when I met with the team a week and a half ago when we returned from Archu. And, they just said straight away, we're going to take this on. It is a very complex piece of land. It's a large piece of land. And as your listeners might be aware, it's not possible to buy or sell land in the Cook Islands. So some of the land has been taken back by owners, landowners, but not a few sections of that land, that particular section. So, and the Nikau Cemetery being one of them, that's our belief. Moving forward, it's a huge relief because we've just relied on the generosity of volunteers, and many, many times I've visited here and the cemetery had become overgrown. Families have visited here from Australia, America, Canada, all over the world. And it's pretty distressing when you can't reach your family member's grave and you've really got no one to turn to because they're just tourists. They don't know anybody who they can talk to about this. So, yeah, we're really grateful for the support and hopefully the ongoing relationship we'll be having with the Cook Islands Investment Corporation in the future.
That was Kate Walker of the Nikau Cemetery in Rarotonga in the Cook Islands.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, 159 years ago on this very day, the General Grant, a three-masted ship carrying gold from Victoria, was engulfed by thick fog. Unable to see the horizon in front of them, the crew were on a collision course with the cliffs of Auckland Island, a remote subarctic island located to the south of New Zealand. The ship ended up inside a mysterious cave before sinking on May 14th. 68 passengers drowned, with only 15 surviving. The ship, with its 73 kilograms of gold, has never been found. Now, on the line with us from New Zealand to have a chat is Bill Day, who has spent years looking for the General Grant. Kia ora, Bill. How are you doing?
Good morning. Hi. Good, thanks.
Now, Bill, this sounds like the beginning of a heist film. So tell us a little bit about the story of General Grant and its castaways. The ship had departed from Melbourne. So how did it end up in a dark cave in a remote subarctic island?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, in those days, no one had bothered to dig the Panama Canal, so the Great Circle route from Melbourne through to London or through to Cape Horn, it takes you to the south of New Zealand, where we've got several subantarctic islands, one of which is the Auckland Island Group. It was 30 miles out of position on the charts anyway, but also the General Grant, they had cloud cover for about 10 days, so the master was never able to get a sun sight with his sextant, and so the position gradually got less and less accurate. Until, you know, one evening the lookout called land ahead, and they tried to turn to avoid the land, but they misinterpreted the bit of land that they saw, and in fact that just drove them deeper into the west coast of the Auckland Islands, where there are huge cliffs, and those cliffs sheltered the wind, and so then they were unable to manoeuvre, and they were just gradually driven over a couple of hours into the cliffs and into a cave or an overhang. And it was dramatic. There's a three-masted bark, and the foremast broke and brought down huge boulders and killed people on the foredeck. And then the second mast, it jammed in the roof of the cave, and it actually held them there overnight. And the master decided they'd stay there. But in the morning, the tide increased and the swell rose, and it lifted the whole ship up against the jammed mast and drove the mast down through the bottom of the ship. So just as they were getting off and leaving, the ship sank and took, I think it was 72 people with it.
My goodness me. And, you know, the castaways would have endured quite a lot. You've been to the Auckland Islands, right, a number of times. Could you describe how difficult it would be to survive on these islands?
Well, it's extraordinary. That's right. So they had 15 of them originally survived the shipwreck, and they got to a harbour in the north end of the Auckland Island Group, and they quickly got some shelter under canvas and so on, and one of them had 13 matches, and they struck 12 of the matches, and they failed to light a fire. And James Teare, the big burly Irishman who was to become their natural leader, he took the last match and he put it in his hair. And he wouldn't let anyone touch it until he was sure it was dry. Billy Sangwilly, the cabin boy, couldn't even look. He turned his head away as they struck that last match, and it lit a fire. And it was a fire that kept them alive, and it was a fire they kept burning for 14 months until it signaled that their rescue was finally.
That lucky last match. another fact,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, another fact that kind of adds to the mystery of these islands is that one of the survivors, David Ashworth, he actually returned to the island years later to try and find the ship, and he disappeared. What happened to him?
So in fact, two of them did. Two survivors went back. So 10 people survived ultimately to get off the island, and there were several attempts to go back by the survivors, and on one of those attempts, two of them left the north end of the Auckland Islands. They went down the west coast in a longboat, and they were never seen again.
Wow. And now you're following in the footsteps of those survivors to try and find the ship and its gold. Could you tell us a little bit about the work that you do and why you've been unable to find it?
Technology has moved on, of course, but I've had several attempts down there, and I've found several other shipwrecks, just not the one we're looking for, and indeed shipwrecks that weren't even known to be there, just that it disappeared sort of somewhere between Australia and Europe. But we know we've got a wreck that's in a cave or a cove or an overhang. We've dived all of those. And then the technology has moved on, where I've taken a thing called a magnetometer and dragged that down the coast. And that detects magnetic anomalies in the Earth's magnetic field. So effectively it detects ferrous metals. Unfortunately, the Auckland Islands are volcanic, and there's ferrous sort of metals everywhere, and just in the geology, and that makes it very difficult. We get a lot of false positives. We've probably done 80 or 90 dives on false positives.
My goodness, how many more false positives do you think you can handle before, you know, you end up giving up hope?
I think I've done all I can do at the moment. I'm a little bit unsure what the next step is. There's a little bit of more information coming out. There's a little bit of historical stuff coming out that may point to something new. My best guess at the moment is the General Grant is buried under a huge landslide and will never come out. You know, it's just one of those enduring mysteries. But it's been a hell of an adventure. It's been great fun. I wouldn't miss a moment of it for the world. I mean, you're out there in a fantastic part of the world, you know, looking for sunken treasure, and we've had bits of different stuff. I mean, and it's great. Every metal tarnishes, you know, steel rusts and silver goes black, except gold. You know, gold's sparkling the day it goes in, and you 300 years later you turn it over and it's sparkling just like that. It's fabulous to find underwater. It's such good fun.
Now, I'm kind of curious, because if you do find the gold, is this a case of finders keepers, or are there legal loopholes involved with claiming the bounty?
Yeah, it's way more complex, actually. That's right. There is legal loopholes. It appears that the original owners and the insurance company no longer exist. There'd be some battle with descendants of the actual passengers, but they probably wouldn't have too much validity in their claim. The New Zealand government does, though, have a claim, and they would typically negotiate. I'd expect a court would award you sort of 70 or 80% of it.
And just lastly, Bill, do you think the General Grant will ever be found?
I'm kind of probably, I'm now less than 50% on it. Having done what I've done and now ascertaining that I think it's buried under a big landslide, then I think that's probably the end of it, which is a shame, you know, but nonetheless, you know, it just keeps the mystery alive.
Fascinating story there. I really hope this becomes a Hollywood story. Thank you very much. That is a marine salvager, Bill Day, speaking to me on the line from New Zealand.
Thanks. Cheers now.
Now it's time to get all the headlines making news around the region this morning. And I'm joined in the studio by producer Jordan Finnell. Good morning.
Good morning, Alice. And can I say you're doing a fantastic job with your first presenting gig for PacBeat. So happy to have you here in the studio.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks to the people behind the scenes, eh? Now, Jordan, let's start in Vanuatu, where new reports show the number of disengaged overseas workers has dropped. What do we know?
Yeah, so this is coming from being reported by the Vanuatu Daily Post. Their reporting says that Vanuatu's Minister for Internal Affairs, Andrew Napuat, has revealed that the number of Ni Vanuatu workers in Australia's Labour Mobility Scheme, also known as the PALM Scheme, has dropped to 200. This is quite significant because the minister says that number used to be 1 or 2,000 people were disengaged and that there's been a significant decrease down to 200. There had been concerns in Vanuatu about the number of disengaged workers and that it was potentially leading to family breakdowns with working parents staying overseas in Australia, and there was much concern in the country about that. But Minister Napuat says the Vanuatu government has been actively engaging with labour mobility partners to encourage workers to return through proper channels.
Now to West Papua, where Human Rights Watch researchers say fighting has increased in the last few months. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is coming from Radio New Zealand Pacific. They have been speaking to Indonesia's Human Rights Watch researcher, Andreas Hasono, who says he's seen the fighting in West Papua escalate in the last month. In fact, he says that the current escalation of violence is some of the most intense that's actually been recorded and witnessed over the past 60 years, which is pretty significant. The United Liberation Movement for West Papua has claimed that allegedly Indonesia has killed one civilian and injured several others in the past week alone. The Indonesian embassy in New Zealand, officials there did not confirm to Radio New Zealand Pacific if there had been a military attack in the region, but they did say that all actions conducted by Indonesia's military are in line with international law. Human rights researcher Andreas Hasono, though, says he has seen an increase in Indonesian soldiers being sent to West Papua under Indonesia's new president, Prabowo Subianto, who is himself a former military leader. So, yeah, interesting to see, and keep our eye on that across the next couple of days.
Absolutely. And we'll trust you to do that. Jordan Finnell, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
No worries.
You might be familiar with our next guest. He's gained a hefty following on social media as the Trustful Guy, or the man with the epic MC intro. Take a listen to this.
You can take the Mooli Bola out of the man, but you can never take the man out of Porirua, as well as Vaiesa Faka and Samonga and Savai. Put your hands together and welcome your MC for this evening, Maa Brian Sangala.
He's definitely coming to a Pasifika event near you. To learn more about the man behind the MC from Aotearoa, New Zealand, we're joined by Maa Brian Sangala. Welcome to the show.
Welcome, welcome. Kia ora, kia rana, whakalofalahi atu, mālo ilelei, sambula, talo hani, talo whakoe, tēnā mauri, halo, le keta wanto, karaki nako mai, halo ni mbilong, mālo, le soifua, maua, malilangi, mamā. Just a very short hello, and thank you so much, Alice, to you and the team at Pacific Beats for the opportunity to talanoa this morning. Really appreciate it, dear.
As you can hear from that fabulous intro, this is the energy he brings to his MC gigs. And, you know, I got to ask, since this video has gone viral of you with your epic MC intro, you know, how's it all changed for you? You've become an online sensation.
Well, yes, but it was only maybe, I'm 54, but it only took 30 years because that's how long I have been emceeing. So it's all new to me, this whole viral sensation. And I'd say that the only reason why I've been posting more regularly is because I'm now full-time emceeing, facilitating, hosting, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, thank you for all the love. And even for the not so much love, because as we know, our own people can be our worst critics. So some of these ones I've had to cry and ask for forgiveness around some of the thoughts I've had towards these comments. So, yes, thank you.
Oh, gosh, it all comes with the good and the bad, but I'm sure there's plenty of good as well. What kind of, you know, opportunities have come about because of, you know, this new virality?
Yes, I like that, virality. I must add that. So I've been able to book a few weddings and birthdays and 21st in Samoa. And so just the power of social media. I've been blessed to be part of the Moana Pasifika ground announcing team. And so, in fact, this Saturday will be myself and two of your former colleagues at PMN, Mr. John Pulu, PMN Tonga, 531 PI, and DJ L Goody. And so it's a real, real spectacle in the best possible way, bringing all the colour and the flavour that only we as Pasifika can bring. Hey.
You know, I'd really like for people to get to know the man behind the MC, because you very much are a person of the community. Can you tell us a little bit about the work you do in the community in Aotearoa and why it's so important for you to serve Pacific communities in particular?
It's a great question, Alice, and I think it's just an extension of who I am as a person. For me, it's important to, you know, to sow and to help organizations. And then, and so for the longest time, I didn't take a fee, but I took a feed to help. And so I went to our Pasifika organizations. And I would say maybe over the last, say, 10 years of emceeing, we've been able to, you know, make good coin or earn a living as a result. But primarily it has been voluntary work. And then seeing the sacrifices that my parents made for me and my brothers growing up, and an extension again of the well-known proverb or well-known saying about it takes a village to raise a child. And so I'm at the stage now where I'm a matua of the village, and I want to pass on whatever knowledge I have, especially to build up and create those spaces and opportunities for the next generation coming through, such as yourself.
You've done so much with the community. You've actually received a lot of recognition as well in the past for what you do. But what some of your online followers might not know is that you are a Queen's Service Medal recipient. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So a few months beforehand, they get in touch with you to see whether you would like to accept or decline the offer. And so I was going to decline the offer, but my wife, full of grace and wisdom, said, "You stupid idiot, what are you doing?" Oh, I was like, oh, I thought of, but it's that humble brag, eh, that us islanders like, oh, nah, humble brag. But I stood there as a sole individual, but behind me was a whole community of people that sowed into my life and who this belonged just as much to them as myself. Whatever semblance of ego I had that day when I got home was quickly shut down. At home on the fridge, we have a schedule for who's on dishes for that any given day. And so I walk through the door a bit, you know, full of myself. And then, hey, guys, Dad just got a Queen's Service Medal. And there was a bit of a pause. And then all of a sudden I heard someone say, one of the kids, oh, Dad, it's your turn for dishes. It's never about the accolades. It's never about the flowers or whatever. For me, yeah, it was great, but we're still going out and doing everything the same, you know, the next day.
And I'm sure the Queen's Service Medal is sitting in the closet, you know, with a bit of a soap residue from that time of you washing
yes,
the dishes.
That and some dust, a lot of dust. So, yes, thank you.
Now, if we could go back to your emceeing, you know, just for a little bit, what advice would you have for upcoming Pacific young ones hoping to follow?
For anyone listening, Pasifika or other, especially to our young people, this is what I always say. Don't ever live down to the stereotypes which society places on you. You have been created with gifts and talents unique to yourself. It is historically factual that we are the greatest wayfarers, navigators the world has ever seen. That is the DNA that is in you. So stand on the shoulders of those that have gone before you, who are now cheering you on from the cloud of witnesses, and go out and change the world.
As one of the young ones who got to work with you in the past, it just goes to show how important it is for young ones to have good mentors in this industry. And I really hope that people get the opportunity, young ones get the opportunity to work with you. So thank you so much, Ma.
Thank you so much, Alice.
And that was former broadcaster and now MC extraordinaire Ma'a Brian Sa'angala. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Thanks so much for your company this morning. Remember, you can catch up on all today's stories online at ABC Radio Australia or ABC Pacific. Tomorrow, Johnson Raera will be back with you at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear Pacific Beat again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daly.